Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'm speaking with my friend, author, and activist, Sister Helen Prejean. This podcast is part of the BeatitudeCenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus and practicing nonviolence and working for a more just, more nonviolent world. I like to begin with a little prayer, so I invite everyone just to, wherever you are, take a deep breath and to relax and enter into the presence of the God of peace who loves you personally, infinitely, and let's welcome the nonviolent Jesus here with us. And just take a moment to ask for whatever grace you need to follow the nonviolent Jesus more faithfully and to do God's will. Beloved God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life and love and peace that you give us. Be with us as we reflect on the life and teachings of the nonviolent Jesus, that we might follow him ever more faithfully and do our part to help end war, poverty, violence, racism, executions, nuclear weapons, environmental destruction, and to welcome your reign of universal love, universal compassion, and universal peace. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Sister Helen Prejean is one of the world's most beloved Catholic leaders and prophetic voices. A sister of St. Joseph of Medai, she's one of the world's leading voices against the death penalty. She's the author of the best-selling book, Dead Man Walking, which was made into the Oscar-winning movie starring Susan Sarandon and Sean Penn. Her work then was turned into an amazing opera, which recently premiered at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York, and it's been turned into a play, and she's written other bestsellers such as The Death of Innocence and River of Fire, a spiritual memoir. Sister Helen is speaking to us today on the phone from her home in New Orleans. Sister Helen Prejean, welcome to my new podcast on the Nonviolent Jesus.
Hey, this is very exciting, John. I'm really glad to be a part of this.
Thank you. So last week, Helen, when I texted you about this and you said yes, you wrote back and said, Jesus ain't no John Wayne Jesus. I mean, what? You mean to tell me Jesus ain't like John Wayne?
Talk to you is right. Listen, when you're working with the death penalty, boy, it really becomes clear, John, because the John Wayne Jesus quotes the sections of the scripture, including revelations in the New Testament, that Jesus is coming back to get justice, and he is PO'd, throwing people into a fiery pit. And here's Jesus coming back. Be afraid, be very afraid. This is the God, our Jesus, of recriminations. You kill, we're going to kill you. Prosecutors making their case to a jury and just saying, he killed. And so what justice means is that we kill him. And God's in favor of this, as if our God is a God who gets justice satisfied by the pound of flesh, a life for life. It is really operative in my world as I work on the death penalty of seeing Jesus in the name of violence being claimed.
That's so powerful, Helen. Well, that I've been running this project, the Beatitude Center, and it's the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, and I just wanted to ask you to say any words you thought about the Beatitudes. I won't read them to you, but because a lot of people from the Beatitude Center will be hearing this. And so Gandhi said that the Sermon on the Mount were the greatest teachings of nonviolence and universal love ever. So he read them every day. And when you read the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit, those who mourn, the meek, the gentle, the nonviolent, those who hunger and thirst for justice, the merciful.
The persecuted,
pure in heart, the peacemakers, and the persecuted. Which ones touch you and inspire you and challenge you these days? When I think of you, Helen, I think of blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Because in the end, isn't that what we're trying to do in our work to end the death penalty, just to grant clemency or mercy, but any words or thoughts about living the Beatitudes?
Yeah, well, definitely the mercy one is very, very operative in my life because I see it played out or not played out.
Yeah.
I mean, I know we will, this will be in January when this airs, but right now, me and a lot of people I know getting to Joe Biden to grant mercy to all the people on the federal death row so Trump doesn't kill them. And we know that he will because he has done that before he left office before. 13 people killed. It's the last vestige of the divine right of kings to decide that people live or die. And so active mercy in the world couldn't be more dramatic or pronounced than you live or you die, or having the power to be able to give mercy to people, which the clemency process and the death penalty does.
So powerful, Helen. I think in terms of Jesus and the death penalty, Jesus as a victim of the death penalty, one of the most amazing stories about Jesus comes from John chapter 8, where he literally saves the life of the woman about to be stoned to death by the religious leaders, who, of course, are all mean, law-abiding men. So I want to say a word about it and ask you. I never got to ask you about John 8. So they bring her there. They're in the sacredest place in the world, the temple. They accuse her, challenge him about her. And what does he do? Instead of yelling back, he bends down and draws on the ground, which I think is an act of creative nonviolence. So he distracts them, draws their attention away from their anger for a moment so that they can hear him, and then he stands up and gives us this punchline, let the one without sin be the first to throw a stone at her. And they walk away, and he does not condemn her, but treats her with compassion. I think the passage forbids Christians from ever killing someone. That we are people who don't condemn, but we try to stop killing and side with the condemned. What's your take on that story of Jesus?
Yeah, well, I think, John, it's very linked to Jesus also saying to love your enemies, pray for your enemies, forgive your enemies. Forgiveness, I think, is really related to that same spirit. Because, and I learned this concretely from a man, Lloyd LeBlanc, whose 17-year-old son was murdered, how forgiveness works in our heart. Because as Lloyd LeBlanc said, it's perceived, forgiveness is perceived as weakness, just like mercy is perceived as weakness. What, you're going to have mercy? The John Wayne Jesus comes in there and says, no, watch this, man, I'm getting even. And that's a whole Rambo thing that has come to us. But what is entailed in forgiving your enemy? If it's not weakness, what is it? And the way Lloyd LeBlanc put it was, after his son was murdered, he was consumed with anger. He wanted to kill with his own bare hands Pat Sonnier and his brother who had killed his son. But here's what he noticed. He kept praying, see, Jesus, you got to help me, because he knew he wasn't in alignment with what Jesus wanted of him in his life. In his own good heart, he knew he wasn't in alignment with eternal life. And he kept praying. And then when the prayer was answered, the way it was answered in him was that he realized that his own anger was eating him alive. And when he came to this realization with the grace that was with it, he put up his hand toward me like a stop, like this. And then he said, I said, they killed my son, but I'm not going to let them kill me. Because if I let this anger keep going inside of me, I'm going to die. I'm already dying. I'm making my wife cry. I'm neglecting my daughter, Vicky. And he came to it as this understanding, this deep compassion, that these were human beings. They had done this to his son, but that he was not going to lose his life because of it. And he was the only one in the town that showed compassion to the mother of Pat and Eddie Sonnier, Gladys Sonnier, who lived in this little town of St. Martinville. He appears at her front door one day, and he's got a basket of fruit, And he hands it to her and he said, "Miss Sonia, I know you're having a tough time in this town, but I want you to know I'm a parent just like you. And we never know really completely all our children might do. And I don't hold you responsible for the death of David, our son. And here, these are for you." And he gave her.
Wow.
There it is in action, see?
Yeah.
And it's saving your own life.
Yeah.
It's the real meaning of peace, that you're not overcome by this violence, which will eat you alive. One victim's family I talked to one time said, "It's like I was drinking this poison of this anger and this hatred, and I was hoping it would kill him. But I'm drinking the poison."
It's amazing. Well, let me ask you more about forgiveness then, because it's at the heart of Jesus' teachings. It's in the Sermon on the Mount. It's in the Lord's Prayer. Forgive us the way we forgive.
Yeah, many times. Probably yeah. The biggest
and
thing.
The brother comes, "Do I have to forgive 7 times a day, my brother?" That's Peter and Andrew. Yeah. And no, 70 times, 7 times. I think that's 490 times a day, by the way. I'm not good with the math. But that's
of course, you can go figure that out.
Yeah, but no, it's... You know, for my life, if I forgive once every month, I'm like, that's a big deal. 490 times a day. So I want to ask you about this. And you remember my story was with my friend Billy Neil Moore, who's the longest on death row in the 80s. And he's about to be executed. And so I go to Georgia and I got Mother Teresa to appeal from. And we were going around the state having public events the week before his execution saying, okay, we're having prayer services for clemency to the Georgia Board of Pardon and Paroles. And Saturday night, I'm in Macon, Georgia, with a big crowded church, and I'm about to go there, and the lawyer shows up from death row with a letter from Billy saying, "Don't you hold a prayer service for me, John. I want you to, just don't do this. Cancel it, because I don't want anyone going to God asking for clemency in my name when none of you grant clemency to the people in your own lives." And it was just one of the greatest moments of my life. Can you imagine? He's about to be executed.
Wait, I got a question. How did he know people weren't granting clemency in their own lives?
I guess he knew me. Yeah, he knew me. You know, we wrote
that'll do.
Yeah. Hey, you're not supposed to agree with him, Hill. You know? No, seriously. When I wrote him every week for 7 years.
Well,
and the first letter I wrote, this is to make you laugh, Helen. "Dear Billy Neil Moore on death row, I'm a Jesuit novice. I'm here to help
you." And I'm on death row too.
Yeah, and I'm here to help you, and I'm writing you, what can I do for you? And without missing a beat, this guy on death row wrote me back. He goes, "Dear John, well, thank you for your letter. I'm fine. My whole life is in the hands of Jesus. You, on the other hand, sound like you're a mess." So here I got Mother Teresa. So we canceled. I want you to talk about this, about forgiveness, because it was life-changing for me. We canceled the prayer service. I stood up and read the letter and said, we're just going to sit in silence for 20 minutes, and I want you all to recall with all the vim and feeling you can all the people you hate. This is what I said, well, and your anger for.
It's great to have those little hate sessions.
Yeah.
That's great, John.
This is a whole new kind of pastoral approach, Helen. And I got them, and we're going to stand up, and we're going to say together, "God of clemency, I grant clemency to everyone who ever hurt me in my life.
Yeah.
Please grant us clemency and give us the miracle of clemency for Billy Neil Moore." Everyone did it. Everyone burst into tears, and as you recall, 3 days later, Billy was granted the first person 150 years in Georgia total clemency, and he's out now. He's 30 years out. He's got a family, and he's a minister.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah,
I think the teaching is to grant clemency.
Okay, let me tell you about forgiveness.
Yeah.
Let's dig into just even look at the word, John. It means forgive. For, F-O-R-E, to give before. So what it means is that largeness of heart to reach out and to give even before something has happened, that what your attitude and what your love is going to be for giving. And that's the way I learned it, through Lloyd LeBlanc, that victim's family. His son had been killed. He said, they killed my son, but they're not going to kill me. He was reaching out in his heart to them, realizing their humanity, his humanity, his own son's humanity, and giving to them before. It's this graciousness. It's this largeness of heart, not to be captured by something that's so constricting and sucking the life from us as anger and hatred. What you think of them apples?
It's so powerful. And as I, in my own life, as I learned from Billy to make forgiveness a daily practice, it's not a one-time thing, but you just feel better. You know, you feel more peaceful.
But you know what? Well, you got to learn not to forgive too easily either, because facile forgiveness is not the real thing either.
Well, then what is it?
Well, because first of all, like, you have to ask for honesty and accountability where injustice has been done. Like right now, I'm writing this book on Manuel Ortiz, who they went after, accusing him of hiring somebody to kill his wife for the insurance money. And they never pursued the women who had been killed, who happened to be two African-American women, both murdered. And they never investigated who actually killed the women. They just went after Manuel, put a bullseye on his back to go get him as the murder-for-hire guy. So I'm not going to forgive them too quickly for what they have done to Manuel. We're going to get accountability and justice. But I'll do it and do it with compassion. Like, they're human. They have made a mistake. And you know, they're stunned with love and compassion to them, not with this anger and vitriol where I start accusing them. I just wrote a letter to the DA who was in charge of the whole case. And that letter is not filled with anger and vitriol or accusations and name calling and all that kind of stuff. It's just like, look, we want to get DNA testing so we can get justice for the two women that were killed, and their real actual killers have never been sought. They're just out there somewhere. It's disrespect for the women who were killed. So that's just an example from my life of, like, not saying, oh, well, they made a mistake, I forgive the prosecutors, they did the wrong thing. It's not mine to forgive them in the first place.
Oh, that's so helpful, Helen. That's great. Thank you. Well, let me ask you then about the death penalty and still about forgiveness. And we still have so much work to do. And thank you for your leadership to end the death penalty in the U.S. And of course, there are many reasons why we need to do so. Just to name some, it doesn't work. It's too expensive. It doesn't deter people stuck in the cycle of violence. It doesn't bring closure or healing or peace, as the victims' families are now telling us. It's part of the legacy of racism and classism, so ingrained.
Well,
in
you got all the talking.
Yeah,
points.
But the one thing that
the evolution of the church is important too in our understanding.
Well, say something about that, but also, you know, you've been telling me about Lloyd LeBlanc, and as I was thinking of you, I thought, you know, the murder victims' families for reconciliation, our friends there, they had their loved ones killed. And they came out publicly saying, don't execute the murderer of
the
my
witnesses.
Family. That's just,
the real
how
witnesses.
Do we get to that place of, we're people of restorative justice, yes, and we want a more nonviolent world, but I don't want anyone killed in the name of my loved one. I met a few people like that with September 11th. But anyway, so tell us.
But this is where, John, we got to work with changing the law and the policies, which legitimize the killing of the enemy.
Okay, tell me.
I mean, we got to work on that. But the evolution of the church is great because it's just growing into the gospel of Jesus in our understanding in the church about the death penalty. Because look, for 1,500 years it took in this dialogue with the church to come to a point of being at the same point as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of the UN, which is that simply by being a human being, we have an inalienable right to life.
Wow.
So governments don't have the power to alienate our life from us. They don't have, governments don't have the power to you know, give people a reward for good behavior or take away their life for bad behavior. And see, all those years of teaching, the church had in its teaching, the state has the right to take life. And that was a sticking point. Even all through the 70s, as the U.S. bishops, as we were all growing and understanding that the death penalty was a bad thing all the way around, they kept holding on to the right to take life. And so the dialogue that happened with me in the church through Pope John Paul II, he was the first one, but then Francis, Pope Francis changed the catechism finding, was once you give the right to the government to take life, you're legitimizing it, and they will set the criteria, and they will say, you know, what are the criteria when we decide that some people need to be killed for what they did. So that power needs to be taken from them. And so then finally in August 2018, Pope Francis was the one who changed the catechism. And so we grow morally, we evolve. And it happened in the 5th century when St. Augustine was the first one to ever depart literally from the Gospels and say we could use violence. Violence could be used to contain the violent. Violent can be coerced with the sword, with the way he put it. And so, but look at what was going on in society. There were no prisons. They had the Visigoths and the Goths and, you know, all knocking down the gates of Rome. There was chaos, no prisons. So as prisons evolved, we have an alternative way of keeping society safe without imitating the violence and killing the killers. And so all of that grew within, mostly in the minds and hearts of the people on the ground. The people of God are the ones who have these direct experiences, and then that experience flows up into the church and changes things. Like it's going to change for the ordination of women, like it's changed for gays, like it. The ordinary experience of incarnation on the ground with real people is what teaches us and helps us grow.
So great. So Francis is now calling for a culture of mercy, a culture of nonviolence. Exactly. He used that phrase, which is so
That's
helpful.
Great.
Now, I want to just talk to you about the way our friend Daniel Berrigan put it, which is the flip side. So he's coming at it from the real negative. And I never asked you this, so I want to hear what you think. When I met Dan 41 years ago as a kid, he said, and I quote, "What we're up against is death as a social methodology." I almost fell out of my chair.
Right.
Yeah. And he said,
but that's exactly
isn't
right.
that powerful? So and then he went on to talk about the means and metaphors of death. Like racism, sexism, greed are metaphors, but really the whole system is death. We bring good people to death. And then I think of my favorite poem is by Edna St. Vincent Millay called Conscientious Objector. And her first sentence, I think it gets into the nonviolent Jesus and resurrection, is, "I shall die, but that is all I shall do for death." Tell me about
that. That's great. No, that's a great line.
Isn't it?
But see, what Dan was on to was this culture of death.
Yeah,
And boy, where you really see it is when you actually have legislators arguing for it, that we have to have death as a statute in our state legislature.
Yeah.
And see, what's different about when the Gregg decision was made in the Supreme Court in 1976, where they said, there are some acts of human beings that are so, they call them the worst of the worst. By their very nature, they demand death, a death for death. And see, that's really a culture of death. Because first of all, that's putting yourself up as being able to judge the difference between an ordinary murder and what we'll call the worst of the worst. And that's why the racism comes in there. I mean, this case right now of Manuel Ortiz, you know, with two African-American women were killed in this white bedroom community of Metairie, Louisiana. And racism comes in there because you don't value some victims as you value other victims. And you would have to have an absolutely pure society to say that you value the life of everyone. You would feel equally outraged if a homeless person got killed, or a young black man got killed, or a white co-ed that goes to Tulane University got killed. And we are nowhere near that. We don't have the purity to be able to do that. So that culture, see, the culture of violence and who uses the violence and who benefits from it. You always got to look at who benefits from it.
Yeah. You know, as you're talking, and you were talking about the historical, for lack of a better word, progress through history of the church, and let's say toward, we want to move, the vision is toward, for Jesus, a culture of mercy, a culture of nonviolence. I was thinking about our friend Archbishop Tutu. So they went farther than anybody has in South Africa.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So Mandela,
talking about a culture, changing the culture.
Yeah, Mandela becomes president. And the Constitution abolishes the death penalty, and they had six nuclear weapons. But then they start the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and remember, Tutu is dealing with, he's the chair of it, the worst, yes, most horrific white people who tortured and killed black people. Mm. And he brings in the greatest psychiatrist in the world from London, and he studies the worst sociopath. And then there's a verdict, and he brings him, the psychiatrist says, oh yeah, everybody's redeemable. And it was such a shock, like, yeah, this person, in other words, well, we're nowhere near like that, that everyone can become more nonviolent, I guess, and
well,
as
yeah,
a culture.
Well,
what do you think about that?
Well, because I've had the warden at Angola prison, tough prison, say to me, do you know who, by and large, becomes our best trustees in this prison? He says, people who come here for murder. Because, see, to try to identify a human being solely with an action, because there's a transcendence in persons. We're made in the image and likeness of God. We can change. And he said most of them that have committed murder didn't know when they got up that morning they would come murder somebody. They got in a fight in a bar. They were on drugs or whatever. People can do unspeakable acts, but they can never be defined solely by an action. People can always change. And Biden even made this statement of the 39 people that he pardoned recently who are there for nonviolent crimes in prison, excessive sentencing, and the people who were sent home because of COVID who have integrated their lives in a nonviolent way. People can always change. And it's when we put ourselves up as the judge, the arrogant judges, to be able to decide, we think that some people are not capable of changes and we have to kill them. That is where the arrogance really comes in and where we lose our humanity. So, boy, that path that they pointed, that Archbishop Tutu and the peace and reconciliation, I mean, we had never seen anything like that. And those families, those wonderful families that attended, heard what they did to their loved ones, and then were willing not to ask violence be done to them. Those are real heroes, I think, of that. And it just shows us, as human beings, what can be done, that we can be more than we are, all of us.
Oh, that's so great. Okay, I want to ask you again about Jesus. So I'm a big name dropper, as you know. I want to ask you about the passage that I've been working on for about 10 or 15 years, which is, I think, Luke 10, where he sends the 72 ahead. And I'll tell you, I want to say a word about it and then just ask you to tell me anything you think about it. Why am I asking you this? Once, years ago, one of our visits at a party or an event, you said to me as I was leaving, isn't it great, John, to be on mission? And I loved that, Helen. And I, no one had ever said that to me before. And like, we knew the Berrigans, wow, were they on a mission? But they wouldn't use that word. So in Luke 10, Jesus sends the 72 out in pairs ahead of him. He's like I always joke that Jesus thinks he's Martin Luther King. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that.
We'll allow you a little anachronism okay, thank you, there. Okay, yeah, okay, thank Jesus you. Thinks he's smart. Okay. Go ahead, John.
So I know it's a setback. So he says, I'm sending you out like lambs into the midst of wolves. Wow. And you got three things. You're to heal the victims of violence. Wow. You're to expel the demons of violence. Okay, you don't need to kill people anymore and so forth. And you're to proclaim God's reign of peace and love and justice. And they come back rejoicing, and he rejoices. And I came to the conclusion, Helen, it's the only time in the four Gospels where the poor guy is happy. Because it's the only place, because they did what he wanted. They were doing, so how do you, what do you think of that passage? And how do you think about, we're all kind of really being sent on a mission into our culture of violence to proclaim the reign of God. And what do you think about that?
Right. But you know what that, what has struck me recently more and more is that expelling of demons seems so weird to us.
Yeah.
You know, demons got these demons. Although, boy, when you are before a legislature and you hear people getting up making these arguments about the death penalty, I mean, they're possessed of this whole thing of we got to do it this way. And their own political careers are tied to it, see. And that's what makes it so it is like a demon. And the other thing about Jesus sending them out with no food, no knapsack, no purse, no why? Because they're going to depend on community. And when violence erupts in our society, like think of gang members killing people to be initiated into the gang, it's because they need community. They need family. And you think of people that have worked with gangs and people like that. It's to belong in some way. So when you belong to a community, and I think this, we can't do justice for longer than a weekend to be on mission for longer than a weekend without our community of support. I mean, I was just with lawyers, human rights lawyers over at my friend Denny LaBeouf's house that are defending the people in Guantanamo, you know, the mastermind of the 9/11 murders, the people who did 9/11. And there they are, and we all having supper together, these great women, three great women. Then we were together, and they are defending people that everybody, almost everybody in the world will say are indefensible. But the victims of 9/11, the families for a peaceful tomorrow, are very aware that getting the death penalty for people in Guantanamo is not the answer to for their peace. And so the whole thing of sending you out, and look, two by two, you don't do it alone. I was just thanking Sister Margaret again today for being with me. For 25 years, we've been doing this. Yeah. And she's right there at my side, and we're doing it together, you know, and we do it in community. And that helps us be peaceful, because if we're out there alone and we feel they're coming after us, that's what makes us violent and defensive.
Oh, that's wonderful, Helen. Thank you. Now,
there'll be no charge.
No, there'll be a small charge. Now, I'm not going to ask you to talk about this. I want to still talk about the women by the cross of Jesus. You've accompanied, I think, seven men to their deaths on death row. Eight men.
It was just another man in Texas.
And you witnessed their executions, which I can't even ponder. And it's hard. I can't. Because of my PTSD in El Salvador. But in terms of the gospel, I see you in the lineage of the holy women who stood with Jesus as he died on the cross, a victim of the death penalty, capital punishment by the Roman Empire for the capital crime of stirring up revolution. Could you share some thoughts about that image? And it's part of the call, or the life, I suppose, of standing in solidarity, grieving, accompaniment with the world's poor, the world's condemned, with Christ being killed today. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, right. What a grace. What a privilege, John. You know, like I was with Ivan Cantu in the execution chamber. I was standing right close to him and praying into his ear as they killed him.
Wow.
And what a grace that is. I mean, people look at me as this, oh, wow, you're so brave to do that. They are brave. They are the ones in grace doing it. And Ivan's last words were to the victim's family. I didn't kill your son and daughter if I'd known who did it. I mean, the thing's so bloody broken. And then to be able to be there and see it's the presence. It's the accompaniment. I don't actually add that much to their life. I just reinforce in him their in them that faith that's already there. And it's such, and you know what? I guess the reason I'm not burnt out on all this and walking away saying I'm never doing that again is the mission I receive from them, the mandate. I can't walk away from the death of Ivan Cantu or the death of Pat Sonier or the death of Robert Lee Willie and Willie Silstein and Dobie Williams and just say, oh, that's too painful. I'm not doing that anymore. I have been a witness. And when you're a witness, as Elie Wiesel put it, witnesses have a mandate and a mission and a charge to tell people and bring them close to what they have seen.
Wow.
So people's hearts can change.
That's so beautiful. I want to ask you about the resurrection of the nonviolent Jesus. And I forgot to bring it, but at the end of my collection of our friend Daniel Berrigan's writings, called Daniel Berrigan Essential Writing, I put in this very, very obscure passage I found. I forgot to bring it, but it goes something like this. You can't run an empire and use death as a social methodology if you have these crazies running around saying, hey, our guy's not dead. And so, and he wrote, you go and look up that passage. It's so funny, but it's so obvious now, like, because death is it. That's all they got to put it. So, how do you understand resurrection? Of course, I want to tell you my take, which is, resurrection means having nothing to do with death and nothing to do with violence and therefore nonviolence. And really, we're getting for resurrection and we're helping people move to the new life of resurrection. Where are you thinking these days about the resurrection of Jesus and the meaning for it for all of us now?
First of all, the great, great insight, which I got through John Dominic Crossan of the Eastern Church's whole approach to the resurrection. So we've always thought of it, or I tended to, as an individual resurrection. Jesus was resurrected from the dead, so we're going to be too. And we picture in our little ego self surviving death, but yet just being ego us. It's all about me, right? I survive, and just shows in those early, early paintings consistently in the Eastern Church of Jesus pulling up Adam and Eve with him, pulling up. He descended into hell, that passage. And we resurrect in community. We do it together.
Oh, that's
it's
wonderful.
Not about this individualized ego being resurrected. So if we begin to learn to love others, now, and I have to tell you that I have actually witnessed, like I'm thinking of Ivan Cantu, who was just killed in Texas February 28th. He was a free man inside. He was facing the anxiety and fear of his death. I said, Ivan, how are you? He goes, well, I'm anxious. I said, well, Jesus was anxious too. How can you not be anxious? You're a human being. This is really a big, big step from which there's no coming back. But he had that will, that freedom within him, which you can sense is resurrection.
Oh, that's great. I want to, because we're at our time, I just want to ask you two little questions, which of course are ridiculous.
Yeah, look, I know you're squeezing too. I know what you're doing.
I know what you're doing. He's not a John Wayne Jesus? Okay. I want to ask you about Dr. King, and I want to ask you about the nonviolent Jesus. Okay, so this month, when this is broadcast, is the 100th birthday of Dr. King. And you know I'm such a fanatic of Dr. King, our great teacher. And it just melts me every time you tell me the story. So I want you to tell everyone again the story in honor of the great man's 100th birthday of the time you met him in the airport.
Yeah, at O'Hare. I was actually, I was coming home for the Christmas holidays. And then when I read his story, I knew he was coming from Cicero, Illinois. It was the most hateful community. They marched in the streets. They threw bricks at him. They spit at him. He was just coming out of that. And lo and behold, I'm standing in line
at the O'Hare Airport.
Yeah, it was O'Hare. I remember I was in Chicago.
So it's like 1966 or 67.
Yeah, it was. It would have been December of 66 because I was going home for Christmas. I remember. And I see him in line. He's behind me, and I said, I think that's daggone Martin Luther King right there. And, you know, I hadn't done anything in the civil rights movement. I learned to play my guitar, to answer my friend is blowing in the wind. I was not awakened yet to social justice. I didn't do beans in the civil rights, okay? And that's where compassion comes in, too, because it took me so blooming long to get awake, John. I was in my 40s when I finally woke up to social justice, okay? But anyway, I see him there, and I was ahead of him in line. So I got out of line, and I went back to him, and I took his hand, and he looked so tired. Mm. And if you see him in pictures of the airport, he's dropping off asleep. It was so tiring. Not just that. Action itself of what they were doing, but all the community struggles they were having. And I said, are you Martin Luther King? And he said, yes, sister. He says, I said, I so appreciate what you're doing, and I'm praying for you. And he took my hand, and he pressed it warmly. He said, thank you, sister. We need prayers. We need prayers so bad. And then I went and got back in the line. I went, I just met Martin Luther King. But when I really met him, was in when I moved in among poor people in the inner city of New Orleans and read his life. That's when I met him.
Thank you, Helen. Thank you for being here and talking about all of these wonderful things and sharing your life with everyone. Any last thoughts, suggestions, tips about following the nonviolent Jesus?
It's fresh. It's always ongoing. I mean, like the meditation today, we're in Advent, and it's Matthew, who's the one who gives us. His name will be Jesus, and he's Emmanuel, the one who uses that. And then that identification, and where is he? Where is he? He's with the poor. He's with the homeless. He's with the people in prison. And it's always fresh for us, the invitation to go live it anew and help Christ be born. Because if we don't help Christ be born with our hands and our eyes and our actions and our books and our whatever we do, Christ doesn't live except in us. That's my thing. Keep it fresh.
Thank you so much, Sister Helen Prejean, for speaking with me.
Great to talk to you, John, as always.
Thank you, friends, for listening to the Nonviolent Jesus podcast. You can hear more podcasts and find other upcoming Zoom programs at beatitudescenter.org. And you can also offer their comments and feedback and make a donation to support this free work. Join me next week when my guest will be Father Richard Rohr, talking about his new book, On the Prophets. May the God of peace bless everyone. Keep on following the nonviolent Jesus like Sister Helen. See you next time.